And welcome back to Earth First Radio. This is Uncle Dennis heading off into our second half of Earth First Radio. So stand by for world news. The Green Millennium Conference held last week in Oaxaca, Mexico was a huge success. Over 80 green parties from literally all over the world, North America, South America, Australasia, Asia, Africa, and Europe, as well as representatives of environmental organizations and non-governmental organizations were in attendance. Among the activities at the conference, which I was pleased to represent Oregon and Northwest Forest Protection Movement, was the issuing of the following statement. It took some work on my part to get the statement expanded to include temperate as well as tropical forests, but it came out fine. The work to build the International Green Party Movement will continue with a Global Green Conference in Canberra, Australia, in March of 2001. For more information on that event, follow the link available at www.greens.org, and here is the Oaxaca Declaration from the Green Millennium Conference. We, the representatives and observers from the green and ecological parties coming from Africa, South America, Central America, North America, Asia, Europe, Oceania, and Australia, met September 20th through 25th at Oaxaca among the Zapotec peoples by invitation of the Federation of the Green Parties of the Americas and the Federation of Ecological and Green Parties of America of Africa. Considering that the year 2000 is approaching and considering the failure of the current models of development, we denounce the military-industrial-financial complex and its role embodied in the multinationals and its contribution to the degradation of ecosystems, climate change, loss of biodiversity, food insecurity, alteration of food through transgenic organisms and agrobusiness, increased social injustice, and the violation of human rights and democracy. We condemn overconsumption and the dogma of economic growth at any cost, the destruction of tropical and temperate forests and ecosystems, all actions leading to desertification, and the international transfer of hazardous, toxic, and nuclear waste to poor countries. We support the cancellation of the debt of poorer nations, the development of socially equitable and environmentally sound economic alternatives, particularly programs for the workers and communities affected by change, and we promote patterns of consumption that are compatible with the environment. We uphold the equality of all humans, demand that full guarantees and respects for political and civil rights of all individuals and all peoples, especially the indigenous peoples, the recognition of cultural and social diversity, and dispel the myth of cultural superiority. We are convinced that cooperation rather than competition, the prevention of conflicts, the elimination of weapons of mass destruction, the drastic reduction in the arms trade, and the suppression of nuclear industry are prerequisites for ensuring that the guaranteeing the clean air, potable water, nutritious food, comfortable shelter, sufficient rural and urban land, health, education, and labor rights supersede vested economic interests. This declaration from the Green Millennium Conference in Oaxaca is a significant step toward a global network to be established following the adoption of the Global Green Charter in Canberra, Australia, April 2001. Listen to some green commentary by Oak. I believe this one's called Snowmobiles.
If I were living deep in the wilds of Hudson's Bay or some such place, it might make sense for me to utilize a snowmobile for long-distance treks. I mean, snowshoes only go so far. But down here in the lower 48, with what seems like a Burger King on every other corner, snowmobiles seem pretty much out of place. Admit it. Most people use these contraptions for thrills. I say the cost to the biosphere is way too high. An extreme example of a sport run amok was revealed when the highest levels of carbon monoxide ever recorded in the nation were discovered a few winters ago at the west entrance of Yellowstone Park. It's been reported that every weekend during the winter, snowmobiles around Old Faithful cause as much air pollution as cars do all year throughout the park. I read recently that there are 2.5 million of these things in use today, and that sales have doubled in the last 5 years. Given that snowmobiles discharge about a third of their fuel unburned onto the snow or into the atmosphere, and that they create havoc for all sorts of wildlife, what are these people thinking? Snowmobiling isn't a sport, it's a recreational assault. The good news is that many national parks are now considering restrictions on snowmobile use. About 60 environmental groups have petitioned the National Park Service to outright ban the use of them within park boundaries. If you want to add your voice to the growing opposition to snowmobiles, check out the Blue Water Network website at www.earthisland.org/BW or call Blue Water at 415-788-3666. Also, check in with local or regional environmental groups to see if similar efforts are being made with regard to state and county land. Until snowmobile manufacturers can come up with some kind of sensible machine, they're destined to meet with resistance. For the most part, snowmobiles as we know them don't make a whole lot of sense. Anyway, that's the view from this oak for Earth First Radio.
And we thank Oak a lot for these commentaries. He's provided one a week for quite a while. So anyway, we'll try and read on here. Hopefully my voice will hang in there. The House Agricultural Committee has approved H.R. 2389, the Deal Boyd County Payments Bill. This dangerous bill is being promoted by the timber industry, and it would perpetuate one of the strongest incentives to log the national forest by continuing to give counties funds generated from timber sale receipts. The bill would guarantee counties $449 million annually, a $224 million increase above current payments. That sounds about double to me. The bill also creates local advisory councils to develop recommendations that shall seek to produce adequate and reliable payments through revenues collected from the historic multiple use of federal lands in accordance with sustainable forestry. And the Deal Boyd bill is now expected to move to the Resources Committee and then onto the House floor. A vote in the House is possible as early as mid-October. In other Hill news, the DeFazio bill, H.R. 2868, proposes to break the link between logging and county payments. Representative Peter DeFazio has introduced an alternative county payments bill. H.R. 2868 would sever the link between payments to counties and the timber sale program. This bill is supported by the Clinton administration and would provide counties with stable funding from the U.S. Treasury. And the DeFazio bill would also increase annual payments to $449 million, matching the Deal Boyd bill. We expect that Representative DeFazio will offer his bill as an amendment to the Deal Boyd bill when it reaches the House floor. To prepare for this, please call 202-225-3121 and ask your representative to co-sponsor the DeFazio bill, H.R. 2868, and to oppose the Deal Boyd bill, H.R. 2389. Once again, that phone number is 202-225-3121. Support H.R. 2868 and oppose H.R. 2389. From Maine, you like blueberries? You think that North American wild blueberries are wild? Nope, they are heavily sprayed with pesticides. This message on so-called wild blueberries goes out to interested parties across the USA and the globe, from those of us who live near blueberry fields in the mid-coast of Maine. These blueberries are being aggressively marketed worldwide as wild and increasingly as beneficial to health and protective against disease. The use of the term wild and its related advertising imagery implies that blueberries grow naturally without pesticides or fertilizers, whereas they are actually sprayed routinely and with increasing frequency, usually by helicopter, with herbicides, fungicides, and insecticides. And from Oregon, we read, a state-appointed panel's findings that Oregon logging rules don't go far enough to allow the governor's salmon recovery plan to succeed sharply increases the pressure on private timber owners to cut less. It's one thing when the enviros say you need big change, said David Bales of the Pacific Rivers Council, an environmental group. It's quite something else when the consensus team appointed on a bipartisan basis and is officially reporting to the state of Oregon says, folks, it's time for a big change. The 7-member independent multidisciplinary science team was appointed by Governor John Kitzhaber, a Democrat in Oregon, and Senate President Brady Adams and House Speaker Lynn Snodgrass, both Republicans. It reviewed the impact of the Oregon Forest Practices Act on Kitzhaber's Oregon plan for restoring dwindling salmon runs. The report found that state logging practices fail to adequately prevent erosion from clear cuts that choke spawning beds. Scientists also said that loggers need to preserve more large trees along streams and in clear cuts that will eventually fall into the water to create pools where fish rest and hide, and to assure fish can swim upstream. The Forest Practices Act fails because it focuses too much on specific sites in action and not enough on the broad landscape, the scientists said. Their report recommended incorporating elements of the Oregon Plan for Salmon Recovery in the Forest Practices Act, developing policies that examine logging impacts over broad landscapes, and bringing old logging roads, a prime source of landslides and fish passage problems, up to modern standards. And in Oregon, in Washington, five groups have appealed the I-90 land exchange, citing numerous violations of federal law, irreparable destruction of rare ecosystems, and potential harm to the local community of Randall, Washington. The groups, including the Gifford Pinchot Task Force, the Northwestern Ecosystem Alliance, the Pacific Crest Biodiversity Project, the National Audubon Society, and the Western Land Exchange, are requesting that publicly owned parcels in the Green River watershed and the Gifford Pinchot National Forest be dropped from the exchange. Quote, "We simply cannot support an exchange that sacrifices rare low-elevation old-growth forests," said Dave Wertz of the Northwest Ecosystem Alliance. Both parcels in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest contain trees that are over four centuries old, some of the oldest trees left in all of Southwest Washington. American Lands and other groups have called for a moratorium on land exchanges pending reforms, including improved public notification and involvement, release of all appraisal data to the public, a ban on trade of all old-growth forests, and a prohibition on any net increase to the public in logging road miles. Oh, boy. And the Big Cypress National Preserve Draft ORV Plan is available for public comment. The National Park Service has released the Draft ORV Management Plan and Supplemental EIS for the Big Cypress National Preserve in Florida. If you want to view an action alert, go to the Florida Biodiversity Project's website at, their project statement is here. The website, www.americanlands.org/forestweb/cypalt. That's cypalt.htm. Once again, www.americanlands.org/forestweb/cypalt.htm, and that'll describe the preserve as a national treasure that is home to 34 endangered, threatened, and protected species, including the Florida panther. The National Park Service currently allows widespread use of ORVs, and the draft management plan is grossly inadequate to halt the destruction, says the alert. Public comments due November 12th are critical in the effort to attain the strongest possible resource protection. For more information, call the Florida Biodiversity Project, 854-922-5828. That's the Florida Biodiversity Project, 854-922-5828. And from Washington, the Sierra Club Board of Directors voted unanimously to oppose the trade of Watch Mountain and Fossil Creek parcels as part of the I-90 land exchange. This overturns the Cascade chapter of the Sierra Club's position, which was, up until yesterday, to trade away thousands of acres of old-growth forest, roadless areas, and endangered species habitat, and to put the town of Randall, Washington, at risk of flooding and mudslides in furtherance of the chapter's goal of acquiring land from the Plum Creek Timber Company far away along Interstate 90. This marks a significant victory for the grassroots forest activist community in Washington State. Many environmental and community leaders have worked tirelessly to stop this disastrous trade from growing through. The fight is very much engaged. A writer was recently attached to the Senate Interior Appropriations Bill, which would order the trade of Watch Mountain and Fossil. Now the Sierra Club has changed its position, the club can join with the vast majority of environmentalists in the state to campaign against the trading of these critically important forest areas. Congratulations are in order to the Sierra Club board members, who endured especially harsh criticism from key leaders in the Cascade chapter as they voted to do the right thing and protect the environment. And also from Washington, the Coquille tribe members, local citizens, and environmental groups appealed the Coquille Forest timber sale. The Bureau of Indian Affairs ruled the appeal will not be considered unless the appellants can first pay a $39,067.66 bond. Judge Dwyer determined on August 2nd that timber sales were not following the Northwest Forest Plan by not surveying for wildlife. Federal agencies canceled timber sale auctions until the problems could be fixed. But the BIA didn't go along. The BIA agreed to cancel the Chua-Cloche auction scheduled for August 31st, but on September 17th, the BIA decided the citizens who appealed the sale must pay, or it doesn't happen. We'll move down to Arizona here. Kafis Industries is pleased to report that its subsidiary Knaf Industries Limited has executed an option agreement giving it the right to sublease and or purchase state land leases that encompass a contiguous parcel of 147,000 acres, 15 miles south of Parker, Arizona. Currently, the option property is used as grazing land and has not been improved for crop production. Knaf Industries has now initiated an in-depth analysis to confirm its initial assessment that the optioned land is suitable for economic production of Knaf. If the initial assessments are correct, the Knaf Industries will plan to plant a test crop of Knaf on the optioned property in early 2000, and the optioned property is only 3 miles distant from a 150-acre site, currently the subject of negotiations between Knaf Industries and the state of Arizona as a potential site for Kafis's second planned North American newsprint mill based entirely on the use of Knaf. And some questions here. A comment is, this may not be good news for Arizona. I saw no mention of the water consumption of such a growing and production project. The article did report that Knaf is a close relative of the cotton plant, which is a major water consumptive crop. Perhaps Arizona, already in water overdraft, is not the appropriate location for this appropriate crop. So even the best of intentions can be fraught with problems. So anyway, I do have a site here for Kafis Industries. Their website is www.kafis, that's kafus.com. All right, or you might try giving them a phone call at 1-888-333-5377 and find out what's happening down there. That's 1-888-333-5377. Ask for Michael McCabe and see if he can let you in on where they're going to get the water for all that Knaf, even though if it does replace trees, that'll be a good thing. But Arizona needs its water, too. Moving up to British Columbia, the British Columbian government took its dispute over native logging to the public arena yesterday, running media ads accusing the West Bank Tribal Nation of breaking the law by cutting trees on Crown land. At the same time, provincial lawyers initiated legal proceedings to stop the ban from logging in a valley outside Kelowna, an area the Aboriginals say is theirs to harvest timber from under a Supreme Court of Canada decision. The West Bank First Nation says that the Delgamuukw'a decision gives them the right to harvest Crown timber. It does not, say the ads, which ran in two newspapers and on radio in the Okanagan region of British Columbia. No court ruling, including the Supreme Court of Canada's Delgamuukw'a ruling, has changed this. There are peaceful legal solutions available. And the members of the West Bank Nation began logging near Hidden Creek 17 days ago after treaty negotiations with the provincial and federal governments broke off. They have since refused to comply with a stop work order from the Ministry of Forests and an attempt to mediate by Phil Fontaine, Grand Chief of the Assembly of First Nations. In the meantime, the native loggers have cut more than 4.5 hectares or 15 truckloads of pine on a site about 20 kilometers northwest of Kelowna. Even though provincial law forbids mills from buying and processing the wood, and so far the standoff has been peaceful. While band members set up an encampment a few kilometers down the road from the work site, they have not prevented forestry officials from entering the area to mark the logs as seized. Foresters, meanwhile, have not attempted to confiscate the logs. The Aboriginals argue the so-called Delgamuukw'a Supreme Court decision of 1997 guarantees their right to natural resources on Crown lands never surrendered by treaty. And in Idaho, the Ninth Circuit Court has blocked a Boise Forest logging site. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals halted a 29.2 million board foot timber sale on Idaho's Boise National Forest, according to a release from the Idaho Sporting Congress. Logging will not occur before the Ninth Circuit hears the ISC appeal of the Idaho District Court ruling that allowed the sales to proceed. The appeal charges the Forest Service with failing to protect old-growth forests and their dependent sensitive wildlife species on the Boise. Ron Mitchell, executive director of the ISC, said the Ninth Circuit decision gives hope to the public, hunters, anglers, and fishermen that piecemeal destruction of their children's outdoor heritage of public forests may soon end in Idaho. You can contact Ron Mitchell at the Idaho Sporting Congress. His number, 208-336-7222. That's 208-336-7222. And here in California, Governor Gray Davis had made a promise in March of 1998 that California activists are now asking him to follow through on. In an address to the Planning and Conservation League Foundation, then-candidate Davis pledged to ensure that wildlands are preserved, rivers are clean, and all old-growth trees are spared from the lumberjack's axe, reported the March 15, 1998 Times Standard of Eureka, California. Environmental Protection Information Center is encouraging activists to send letters and calls to Governor Davis asking him to keep his promise. Contact Susan Maloney at EPIC for more information. Her email address, epic@wildcalifornia.org. That's epic@wildcalifornia.org, or call 707-923-2931. That's 707-923-2931. And you can send your letters to Governor Gray Davis, State Capitol, Sacramento, California, 95814. That's Governor Gray Davis, State Capitol, Sacramento, California, 95814. All right. In news from Southern California, Victorville now becomes the hard part of an ambitious effort to protect sensitive plants and animals on more than 14,000 square miles of the Mojave Desert. The scientific research is almost done, but starting in November, a group including environmentalists, miners, and off-roaders will try to agree on what's needed to protect the species. There are going to be areas we agree on, and I think there will be a lot of them, said Marie Brashear of the National Outdoor Coalition, which favors multiple uses on public lands, including mining and off-highway vehicles. When it comes to the nitty-gritty of what's going to be done on the ground, there will be disagreements. Suggestions to protect more than 100 species to be included in the West Mojave Plan were released Wednesday at a meeting of the so-called supergroup, made up of state and federal wildlife agencies, environmental groups, mining and off-road groups, plus officials from the four counties and cities the plan touches. And if you'd like more information, I don't know how you're going to get it. Oh, here we go. Contact Leona Klipstein, Spirit of the Sage Council, at www.sagecouncil.com. That's www.sagecouncil.com. And email is to mail@sbcsun.com. All right. Well, that's it for the news today. To get your news announcements or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, here it is, folks. Our email address is cruzef@cruzio.com. That's cruzef@cruzio.com. cruzef@cruzio.com. We love to get your email. You can also send letters, donations, CDs, cassettes, or anything more physical and tangible to Earth First Radio. Keep it friendly, please. P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. That's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please, send those announcements 3 weeks in advance. And for more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 1415, Eugene, Oregon, 97440. Earth First Radio is broadcast live from the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, every Thursday evening at 8 p.m., or you can listen to Earth First Radio anytime on your computer on the World Wide Web. Point your browser to radioforall.web.net. That's http://radioforall4.web.net. You'll need a sound card, but the software you need is free on the website. And I'm pleased to announce that Earth First Radio is being rebroadcast on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. If you found us on the web, Your local radio station can too. Ask them to download and rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney from the CD Keep It Wild. Earth First Radio is affiliated with the Earth First Radio Network. My name is Uncle Dennis, and thank you for listening, and please tune in again. We're going to get on out of here with a tune from Daryl Cherney, and this one's off his cassette called Timber, and transcribed onto Dennis's Earth First CD number one. This one is called Rio Grande.
I was born south of the border, but I could not find a job. I swam across the Rio Grande. I paid $1,000 to the mob. I traveled up to Mendocino, where I found work in forestry. They paid me $7 an hour, holding green chain for LP. But now LP, they moved to Mexico. Pretty bummed. $1,000 I paid the coyote. It didn't come with no refund. They left Ukiah a ghost town. I didn't know that's what they planned. And how my arms were getting tired, swimming across the Rio Grande. I was born here in Ukiah. I worked here at the LP mill. I watched them kill the Russian River and a couple friends of mine as well. I work 6 10-hour shifts a week. So where's my pad on the back? I wanna keep on milling redwoods. I better learn some Spanish jack. Because they'll be able to Mexico. Yes, this cowboy is sad.